From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Iraqis are very well aware that their weapons don't match the American weapons, but their attitude is that it's their country and they have a cause that they're fighting for, and that is eventually going to be their strongest weapon, that they have a cause they believe in and the Americans don't. That's
gun battles rage in cities across Iraq as the U.S. faces a nightmare scenario of fighting a united Shia-Sunni uprising. We'll speak with independent reporter Mei Ying Welsh. We'll take a look at the Bush administration and the state of the U.S. media today with the longest-serving member of the White House press corps, the legendary Helen Thomas.
War is killing and being killed. And if we don't have the courage to stand up and ask a question when we are so privileged, we have defaulted on our profession.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Resistance against the U.S. occupation in Iraq has spread across the country from as north as Kirkuk to southern Iraq. The U.S. occupying forces have lost control of at least three cities, Najaf, Karbala, and Kufa, to followers of the Shia leader Muqtada al-Sadr. Facing the increasing resistance, the Pentagon signaled Wednesday it would probably delay bringing home as many as 25,000 soldiers from the 1st Armored Division as scheduled. At least 40 U.S. soldiers have died in the past week, the most of any week since the fall of Baghdad. The fiercest fighting occurred in Fallujah, where Sunni Iraqis will maintain control of three-quarters of the city, where the U.S. has staged a large offensive involving over 2,000 Marines. On Wednesday, the U.S. purposely bombed a mosque they claimed was being used by the resistance. Witnesses said 40 people died, but the military said only one person was killed in the attack. The head of Fallujah's main hospital reports at least 280 Iraqis have died since the U.S. sealed off the city. 400 have been wounded. The Independent of London is reporting the U.S. has blocked all traffic from entering Fallujah, including ambulances. Fallujah has become a leading symbol of Iraqi nationalism among both Sunni and Shiites. In Baghdad, hundreds of Iraqis lined up in the streets to give blood to the victims in Fallujah. One Iraqi told reporters, quote, "We are giving our blood and money here now, but this is just the start. We will give our souls. This will be worse than Vietnam. The Shia and Sunni will fight together," he said. Sadr also issued a statement Wednesday making a comparison to Vietnam. He said, quote, "I call upon the American people to stand beside their brethren, the Iraqi people, who are suffering an injustice by your rulers and the occupying army, to help them in the transfer of power to honest Iraqis. Otherwise, Iraq will be another Vietnam for America and the occupiers." Sadr also urged the Kuwaiti government to expel the U.S. military from Kuwait. More signs emerge that Sunnis and Shias are joining together to oppose the U.S. occupation. Posters of the Shiite leader Sadr have been pasted throughout Sunni areas of Baghdad. Shiite clerics are urging followers to support their Sunni brethren in Fallujah. In the northern city of Kirkuk, U.S. forces killed 8 Iraqis who were protesting the U.S. raids in Fallujah. In Washington, the Bush administration continued to downplay the Iraqi uprising. At a press conference on Wednesday, Donald Rumsfeld said the fighting was just the work of thugs, gangs, and terrorists, and not a popular uprising. General Myers added, quote, "It's not a Shiite uprising. Sadr has a very small following." But the New York Times reports otherwise. Experts within the intelligence community said the U.S. is facing a broad-based Shiite uprising, even if the rebellion has not been explicitly supported by the country's chief Shiite leader, Grand Ayatollah Sistani. On Wednesday, Sistani did his first official statement on the recent uprising. He called for a peaceful resolution, but said, quote, "We condemn the way the occupying forces are dealing with current events." On Capitol Hill, Senior Senator Robert Byrd called for the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq, but Rumsfeld vowed to stay the course. President Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice going before the 9/11 Commission today for 2 hours of public questioning under oath. White House officials said Wednesday Rice has no plans to make a public apology for the September 11th attacks. Amnesty International has issued a report that found the U.S. and three other countries were responsible for 84% of the executions around the world last year. The three other countries were China, Iran, and Vietnam. China executed 726 people. Iran executed 108. The United States was third with 65 executions. In India, a landmine blast has killed at least 26 policemen. In Hattiesburg, Mississippi, two reporters were ordered Wednesday to erase their tape recordings of a speech given by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia at a Mississippi high school. According to the Associated Press, a deputy federal marshal took a digital recorder from the hands of an AP reporter after she refused to erase the tape. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Resistance against the U.S. occupation of Iraq has spread across the country from as far north as Kirkuk down to southern Iraq. The U.S. occupying forces have lost control of at least three cities, Najaf, Karbala, and Kufa, to followers of the Shia leader Muqtada Sadr. The U.S. is now battling Sunni and Shiite fighters in cities across the country. In Baghdad, once quiet areas such as Adamiya, fighting has broken out between Sunnis and the U.S. Yesterday late, we got a call from independent reporter Mei Ying Welsh, who was in the midst of a battle.
Right now, I'm in the Adamiya section of Baghdad. It's a historic Sunni area with very narrow and winding streets. The streets here are so tight, it's hard for two cars to pass each other. Prowling these streets are scores of fedayeen, young men with their faces covered with scarves, carrying weapons, and some of them are wearing soccer jerseys with the word Iraq emblazoned on them. On the other side are the U.S. forces who pulled up in several places in the neighborhood, including, ironically, the royal tombs where the former kings of Iraq are buried. I spoke to one of these fedayeen, and his friends were with him as well. He was only carrying a small pistol, but his friends had some more serious weaponry. They had rocket-propelled grenades and AK-47s, and they told me they're planning to fight till dawn. This one fedayeen told me, he said, "We're not afraid, but the Americans are very afraid," he said, "because they don't have a goal, and we do." And I asked him, "What is your goal?" And he said, "My goal is martyrdom and the liberation of Iraq." And he said, "But they don't know why they're here." They also said that they would fight to kick the Americans out of Iraq no matter how long it took. Right now, I can hear an ongoing battle, and you can hear the huge boom of the RPGs when they fire. You can hear tank fire, which sounds like a bomb dropping, massive bursts of machine gun fire, small arms fire. There are helicopter gunships continuously circling the skies over this neighborhood. And, you know, even despite all of this, there's some children playing in the street and people sitting on their doorsteps because people want to see what's going on, and they don't seem to be afraid of the fedayeen. In fact, they speak freely with them. It's the Americans they're afraid of. So as soon as the American tanks come or they start seeing Americans coming down the street, everybody runs into their home. This whole battle started right as the sun was going down. As soon as the sun started going down, we started to see the fedayeen start going out into the streets, and we saw an American tank preceded by several soldiers on foot. I guess they were snipers, and they seemed very well trained, and they were kind of running back and forth and hiding behind things. We're walking in front of that tank, and then the clashes began. This area is a very, very Sunni area, which has been seething with resentment for the occupation for the past year, but which has been relatively quiet until now. The clashes here started 2 days ago. And last night was quiet. They've started up again tonight. I spent time with two families in this neighborhood tonight, and they said very similar things. One of them said the reason why they entered Adamiya is because it's a patriotic Islamic area. And they said, and the Americans don't want an Iraqi patriotism, and they hate Islam. Another one said something similar, and he said one of the father, the head of the household, he said, we can't be victorious over the Americans because their weapons are so powerful. But he said, but over the passing of time, they'll take so many losses here, they'll be defeated just like they were in Somalia and Vietnam. I also spoke with the imam of the main mosque here, which is a very, very old mosque. It's more than 1,000 years old, the Abu Hanifa Mosque. Sheikh Muayyad Ibrahim al-Azami told me that he said the Americans are lost in Iraq. He said they're lost in the darkness because of their arrogance. Now, earlier today, we were able to see thousands of people lining up at his mosque to give blood, food supplies, and money to the people of Fallujah. Literally, thousands of people came to this mosque because they had been asked to give as much blood as possible. And the atmosphere in the mosque as the sun was going down was incredibly tense. The imam was sitting in his office shuffling papers nervously, and many aides were sitting around him counting the money they had gathered throughout the day from residents. The imam told me, we collected these medical supplies and food supplies and other things, and perhaps this will anger the Americans, and they're going to take revenge on this neighborhood. And it was only a few, minutes after he uttered those words that we started to see the tank, the American tank, coming into the neighborhood, preceded by several snipers on foot, and began to engage the Sarayin in this neighborhood. The imam of the mosque also told me, if the Americans are not wise, the situation will get worse and more bloody. He fully expects that if the Americans continue to use force, that this is going to spiral downward. Now, another significant development is that one of the most important groups in Iraq, the most important religious groups for Sunni Muslims in Iraq, issued a statement today of demand. And they haven't called as a group for jihad at this time, but they have issued some demands. And those demands are they want the United Nations to condemn the occupation. They want a general strike throughout the entire country of Iraq until U.S. forces stop the siege on Fallujah. And they want a hunger strike in mosques until America stops its war. This particular group, the Union of Islamic Scholars, is a very powerful and influential group for the Sunni Muslims of Iraq. And most Sunni Muslim leaders are members of this group or follow this group. So this is a very important statement coming from the Sunni Muslims of Iraq.
We're talking to Mei Ying Welsh, and she is in the midst of a battle in Adamiya, just outside of Baghdad. You talk about the Fedayeen. Can you describe who they are?
Well, all of the Fedayeen are young men, and it's not possible to find out their names or where they're from because they're trying to conceal their identities. I mean, they've covered their faces with scars, and they only come out at night. These battles do not occur during the day because the Fedayeen don't want their identities to be revealed. Also, they don't want to endanger women, children, people that are in the street during the day when the streets are very crowded. I asked one of the Fedayeen, where are you from? Are you from this neighborhood? And he refused to answer that question. He said, I'm from Iraq. That's all he would say. So, these people are secretive, about how they gather, how many of them there are, where they're from, things like that. He wouldn't answer questions about how many of them there were. And, we hear rumors that, that 100 people from Jaish Mahdi, the militia following the Shia leader Muqtada Sadr, came over here last night to help. Now, that's just a rumor, and it's really kind of impossible to confirm because people don't want to reveal, their... for operational security, how they're fighting the Americans, with what means, the level of their equipment, things like that. But I can just say anecdotally that from what I can see, they don't have very heavy weapons to go up against the Americans with. The best kind of weaponry they have are rocket-propelled grenades, which are capable of destroying tanks. But, the one Fedayeen that I spoke to, he only had a small pistol, and some of his friends in AK-47s. And I think that their attitude is not that, you know, they're very well aware that, that their weapons are not a match for the American weapons. This is something we hear repeated over and over again. Iraqis are very well aware that their weapons don't match the American weapons. But their attitude is that it's their country and they have a cause that they're fighting for, and that is eventually going to be their strongest weapon, that they have a cause they believe in and the Americans don't. That's what I keep hearing over and over from them. And they feel that they can tire the Americans out and that they'll leave. One of the neighbors here told me that what's going on here, he described it as a general revolution against the Americans. And he said they don't have enough forces and they don't know what to do. He said they don't have enough forces and they're afraid. He said they didn't expect things to reach this point. They didn't expect the Sunnis and Shias to unite in this way. You know, because like I was saying before, Azamia has been a quiet neighborhood for the past year, even though the residents here have been generally more angry with the occupation than other neighborhoods of Baghdad. Other neighborhoods of Baghdad, you can find people who thought the occupation was something good and who want the Americans to stay because they think Americans are preventing the country from sliding into civil war. You can find people like that in other neighborhoods, not this neighborhood. This is a very, very, what can I say? This is a very Islamic neighborhood and a very, very anti-American neighborhood. So these people have always been against the occupation, but they didn't rise up until they saw the Shias rising up. And then that's another thing people have said to me here is when they saw the Shias rising up, the Shias who no one expected to rise up and who everyone expected to stay quiet, they felt guilty and they said, why are we staying quiet when our Shia brothers are fighting the Americans? And that is the spark that sort of pushed them along with the siege of Fallujah, which pushed them to fight the Americans now.
We're talking to Mei Ying Welsh. She is in Azamia, just outside Baghdad. The U.S. administration has been calling the people who are resisting thugs and terrorists. Your response?
Well, the response of most of the people in this neighborhood to that would definitely be, how can we be thugs and terrorists when we're defending our country? I mean, you know, yesterday I spoke with a man who lost his son and two of his nephews in the U.S. bombing of Iraq a year ago. And one of the points that he was really, really angry about was he felt angry that America was calling the war on Iraq or the occupation of Iraq part of this war on terror. And he said, how can they call me a terrorist when I'm defending my country? And they invaded my country. I didn't invade their country. He said, anyone who is defending their country cannot be described as a terrorist. They should be described as a patriot. And he asked the question, which all Iraqis ask when you bring up this kind of thing, how would America feel if Iraq went and occupied America? Wouldn't they try and kick the Iraqis out, or would they just say, welcome, come on in and stay? You know, so Iraqis definitely would bridle at the idea that they are the thugs and the terrorists when in fact they're the ones who are occupied.
And the news in the last days is that the Sunnis and Shiites are fighting not against each other, but together against the Americans. Can you comment on this?
Well, I've been hearing from both Sunnis and Shias a lot of talk about sort of like a joint resistance. Last night, I went to Shu'ala, which is a very poor Shia neighborhood on the outskirts of Baghdad, and I spoke with some people there. And they told me that there are now ongoing contacts and coordination between Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric, militia, and his supporters, and the resistance in Fallujah and in other parts of the country, Sunni parts of Baghdad and other Sunni parts of the country. He said there's ongoing contact and coordination. And he said it's just a matter of time until there's a joint plan for resistance. And I asked them, when do you think this joint plan for resistance could come about? Because honestly, you know, Sunnis and Shias in this country, they always talk about how they're one and everybody is one and there's no difference between us and we're all Muslims. But the truth is, when you get them alone, they all start saying how awful the other ones are. The Shias start saying, oh, all the terrorists come from the Sunnis. And the Sunnis start saying, you know, oh, the Shias, they're all, you know, they're all the looters, all the people that do the looting and stealing and crime in Iraq come from the Shias. I mean, they say terrible things about each other. basically. So, you know, the unity, I think, between them is based on a mutual anger against the occupation and the U.S. forces, not on a whole lot of mutual feelings between them. But, you know, I think that there is right now a confluence of interests going on between the Sunnis and Shias. It's a patriotic confluence of interests to kick the Americans out. And how deep it is, I mean, if the Americans actually left, I don't know. I can't say that this place wouldn't then just fall into a civil war.
Independent reporter Mei Ying Welsh in Baghdad, in Adamiya. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the legendary White House reporter, Helen Thomas. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! That was Angelique Kidjo. I'm Amy Goodman. The War and Peace Report. For more than a year, people have been asking, where is the independent press in this country? Where are the critical questions being asked of Donald Rumsfeld and General Colin Powell, George Bush, and Condoleezza Rice? As people like the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said, we don't want the smoking gun to become a mushroom cloud, as they talked about the direct threat of Saddam Hussein. Where were the reporters asking for the evidence and dissecting the information that was being presented? On March 6, 2003, right before the invasion, President Bush conducted just the second White House press conference since taking office 14 months earlier. The only previous news conference he'd given was 1 month after 9/11, as the U.S. was beginning the so-called War on Terror. This time, in March, it was on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. Although reiterating several times at the news conference that he had not made a decision to go to war, Bush repeatedly told reporters Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass terror and that he was a direct threat to the United States. With the nation watching, the White House press corps assembled in the East Room lobbed softballs at Bush, refusing to challenge the president for his reasons to lead the country into war. New York Times White House correspondent Elizabeth Buemiller, who was at the now famous news conference, responded to criticism that reporters were too easy on Bush. She was questioned recently at a forum on the press and the presidency organized by Towson University and the University of California Washington Center last month. This is an excerpt of what the New York Times reporter Elizabeth Buemiller had to say.
I think we were very deferential because, you know, in an East Room press conference, it's live, it's very intense. It's frightening to stand up there. I mean, think about it. You're standing up on primetime live television asking the President of the United States a question when the country's about to go to war. There was a very serious, somber tone that evening, and I think it made – and, you know, nobody wanted to get into an argument with the president. Mm-hmm. This very serious time. And it had a very heavy feeling of history to it, that mm-hmm. press conference.
New York Times White House correspondent Elizabeth Buemiller speaking just a few weeks ago on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. To get a response to Buemiller's eyebrow-raising comments, we called veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas. Commonly referred to as the First Lady of the Press, she is the most senior member of the White House Press Corps. She served as White House correspondent for United Press International for some 57 years and has covered every president since John F. Kennedy. President Gerald Ford once remarked, quote, "If God created the earth in 6 days, he couldn't have rested on the seventh. He would have had to explain it to Helen Thomas." In response to Elizabeth Buemiller's comments last week, I asked Helen Thomas about the state of the White House press corps today.
My answer to that is she's absolutely right. It is intimidating, but that's when we should have had more courage. We should have definitely asked for motives for going to war, proof of weapons, and so forth. He should not have been given a free ride, because when you're going to war, it means war is killing and being killed. And if we don't have the courage to stand up and ask a question when we are so privileged, we have defaulted on our profession.
You include yourself, but at that news conference, if I recall correctly, you were sidelined. You're no longer welcoming the president. You didn't even get a chance to ask a question.
That's right.
Can you describe what happened? We didn't see you in the front row anymore.
Well, I'm still in the front row. I have a front row seat at the briefings, but not at the news conference. And the president is given a certain list of reporters to call on. Well, when I walked into the room, I guess I was a little bit miffed to be put in the back. But at the same time, you know, as Elizabeth said, it is intimidating. So I said, well, I'll relax and enjoy it, maybe, and pray that the reporters will ask the tough questions that should be asked.
In a situation like that, if I recall correctly, Dana Milbank of the New York Times was also was not able to ask a question. In a situation like that where it has been tradition for you to ask questions, Helen Thomas, you've covered every president since John Kennedy. Well, the reporters could have bucked the protocol, could have stopped you being iced out simply by saying, I defer to Helen Thomas, isn't that right?
Oh, no. You know, what really happened is I had changed my position. As a wire service reporter, both UPI and AP used to get the first two questions at any formal news conference. It's a tradition that goes back to FDR and long before the advent of television. But I was no longer with UPI, so I really didn't deserve one of the front row questions at all. But it didn't matter where I sat. It would have been nice to be called on, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that the president did get a free ride that night, and it was a very, very important night. It was important to the American people to know why we were going to war. And my colleagues have been wonderful. I didn't want to become a cause celeb, and I certainly didn't want to be defended. I think I can hold my own.
Dana Milbank, too, I just wanted to correct, he works for the Washington Post. But perhaps it had something to do with the line of questioning that you were pursuing. I wanted to play for the listeners and viewers for a moment. Your questioning, it was about a month and a half before, and it was then your confrontation, if you will, with White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer.
Mm-hmm.
Ari, you said the president deplored the taking of innocent lives. So does that apply to all innocent lives in the world?
Well, Helen,
and I have a follow-up.
I refer specifically to a horrible terrorist attack in Tel Aviv that killed scores and wounded hundreds. And the president, as he said in a statement yesterday, deplores in the strongest terms the taking of those lives and the wounding of those people, innocents in Israel.
My follow-up is, why does he want to drop bombs on innocent Iraqis?
Helen, the question is how to protect Americans and our allies and friends from a country.
Have they laid the glove on you or on the United States, the Iraqs, in 11 years?
I guess you've forgotten about the Americans who were killed in the first Gulf War as a result of Saddam Hussein's aggression then.
Is this your revenge? 11 years of revenge?
Helen, I think you know very well that the president's position is that he wants to avert war, and that the president has asked the United Nations to go into Iraq to help with the purpose of averting war.
The president attacked innocent Iraqi lives.
The president wants to make certain that he can defend our country, to defend our interests, defend the region, and make certain that American lives are not lost. There's no question that the president thinks that Iraq is a threat to the United States.
The Iraqi people?
The Iraqi people are represented by their government. If there was regime change, the Iraqi... Actually, the president has made it very clear that he has no dispute with the people of Iraq. That's why the American policy remains a policy of regime change. There is no question that the people of Iraq...
For them to make, isn't it? It's their country.
Helen, if you think that the people of Iraq are in a position to dictate who their dictator is, I don't think that's been what history has shown.
As you listen to that questioning you did of then White House Press Secretary,
I wish I had thought of better answers.
What do you see your role?
Monday morning quarterbacking, you know.
What do you see your role as a reporter?
Well, I'm a columnist now, and I have so much more freedom to express my opinions and so forth. I do think that we have to be constantly skeptical of what they're dishing out these days and constantly questioning and putting them on the spot and making them explain, and of course they don't.
You wrote a piece today about two people who have spoken out from within the Bush administration, two career government officials, Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, and another longtime civil servant, Richard Foster, the Medicare program's chief actuary. Can you talk about the effect of their statements and what they said and how it has changed the White House?
Well, I think that they're circling the wagons. They definitely went on the defense. They pushed the panic button. They're not, you know, everyone in this administration has been on board with us or against us. There's no room for a devil's advocate or dissenter. And so these breakthroughs were, I think, moments of truth and refreshing, to put it mildly, and I think people have a right to know what they said and what they obviously are telling the truth, in my opinion.
What about the president somewhat backing down on Condoleezza Rice, saying now that she would be able to testify before the 9/11 commission?
A lot. He changes his mind a lot depending on the atmosphere. That's why I keep telling my colleagues we should push for more news conferences, because eventually every president has felt that pressure, not just President Bush, but all of them. None of them want to hold news conferences and be accountable to the American people. So I think that, sure, he changes his mind a lot.
President George W. Bush has held far fewer news conferences than any other president in recent history, including his father. When was the last time you got to ask him a question?
Well, the last time that he held one was December 15, so that's pretty bad. And I forget, I think he had held one 2 months earlier, which I attended. So, anyway, it's... doesn't matter whether I'm there or not. What matters is that he be quizzed.
How does President Bush compare to his father, compare to President Reagan, Carter, going right back to John Kennedy?
Compare in what way?
Well, compare in what it's been like to cover them. Cover their White House.
Much, much more secretive. The others were more freewheeling. I mean, I think President Reagan was pretty detached, but people did have the feeling of mourning in America and Mr. Nice Guy and so forth. The others were, they all keep us at arm's length, no question about that, except back in the early days we used to do the Bataan death marches around the South Lawn with President Johnson. He'd let his hair down and tell us a lot that we didn't expect to learn, personal, and what he was going through on the Vietnam War. But more and more presidents are more detached, they're more encircled by their security, they're more handled, and they're more wary. So it is different, except President Bush's father used to drop into the press room and chatter a lot, and he was a hail fellow in many ways, so he didn't. I don't think he had that real barrier against the press, but he did. He and his wife did blame the media during his reelection campaign in '92. They felt he had not been given a fair shake.
Is George Bush's White House right now a White House under siege or simply one in an election campaign?
Oh, I think there it's calculating every inch of the way, every minute, every day, all pointed toward the election. They're not under siege per se, but every new crisis that comes up, they obviously have war games and figure out what they're going to say. Their spokesperson is on one page, never gets off the reservation, has no running room, so everything's locked down.
And what about the investigation going on at the White House of the leak? The Joseph Wilson, the former acting ambassador in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War, comes out and says that the Bush White House knew that Saddam Hussein had not bought uranium from Niger, and the response being someone in the White House leaking that Joe Wilson's wife was a CIA operative in retaliation. How has that affected the White House press corps, and what do you think the White House press should do?
I'm going to be shocked when they come up with the answer, which everybody seems to know. At least I would say they would know. At least eight reporters know, and their bosses probably know, and we're all, you know, I don't know personally, but it seems to me it's an awfully long investigation for a very small matter. Not in terms of the importance of the matter, but it shouldn't be that difficult to track down if they want to.
Would you say that the press in this country has reached an all-time low? A kind of drum beating for war leading up to the invasion?
Oh, I'd never say that. There are always reporters who are driving, alert, waiting for the end, who have a lot of courage all over this country, no question about it. But I do think that, of course, in wartime, there is a certain aura and an atmosphere where you don't really want to rock the boat too much or hurt anyone.
Why did you leave UPI, Helen Thomas?
Why did I leave? It was time to go.
What about the ownership change?
Well, that had something to do with it, obviously. But I wish them well. I mean, I want us to have two wireless services at least in this country. Monopolies are not good.
What do you think is the most important issue right now to be pursued at the White House?
Oh, I think war, the commitment of this country, people dying every day for us. And maybe the American, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. We don't really see war per se as they do in Iraq, or maybe the Arab TV shows a little bit more of the horror of war. And we've been pretty protected from that. We don't see the body bags. We don't see go to the honor guard ceremonies. When you ask about Iraqi casualties, they say they don't count. I say, but you're liberating them. I thought they did count. Well, the numbers don't count, they say, and so forth. So I think that maybe war is not as important to some people, but I think it should be, because it's our whole country's commitment. It's our honor.
Do you think that reporters in this country should treat the casualty counts of Iraqis any differently than they treat the casualty counts of people from the United States?
I'll go with John Donne, that each man's life diminishes, death diminishes us all. Everybody counts.
Your colleagues, Dan Rather, the day the bombs were falling on Iraq a year ago, said, "Good morning, Baghdad." He also said on David Letterman, "George Bush is the president. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where, and he'll make the call." That was right after September 11th, 2001. And Tom Brokaw, on the night of the bombs falling, said, "One of the things that we don't want to do is to destroy the infrastructure of Iraq, because in a few days we're going to own that country." Your response?
My response is they were being, you know, it's my country, may she always be right, but my country, right or wrong. And I think they were being patriotic, or trying to be.
And what does that mean when it comes to being a reporter?
I think it's very difficult to break out of the mold. And, you know, in the heat of the battle, I don't think you really break loose from your own country, even if you think she's wrong. And I don't think, maybe they thought she was right. I don't know what was in their mind.
Let me read you something from the Columbia Journalism Review, tip of the hat. It's critique and analysis of the 2004 campaign coverage. It's by Zachary Roth, and he starts, "An extraordinary piece in the January 19th New Yorker, Ken Auletta explores the Bush administration's deeply held conviction that the press is just another special interest group, not a champion of the public interest. What's striking is the candid, on-the-record comments that Auletta elicited from administration officials from the top down. Auletta leads off with the following anecdote from a Crawford, Texas barbecue last August. Quote, during a conversation with reporters, Bush explained, perhaps without intending to, why his White House often seems indifferent to the press. How do you know, then, what the public thinks, a reporter asks, according to Bush aides and reporters who heard the exchange. And Bush replied, you're making a huge assumption that you represent what the public thinks. Another money quote comes from Chief of Staff Andy Card, who says acidly of the press, they don't represent the public any more than other people do. In our democracy, the people who represent the public stood for election. Auletta notes that Bush has given far fewer press conferences at this point in his tenure than any of his predecessors since the advent of television, that he hasn't given an in-depth interview to the New York Times since taking office, and that staffers boast of not answering reporters' questions. He gets more gems out of Karl Rove, who says of Bush, he understands that the press's job is not necessarily to report the news. It's to get a headline or get a story that will make people pay attention to their magazine, newspaper, or television more. What's unnerving about Rove's comment, of course, is that there's obviously a grain of truth to it. Your response, Helen Thomas.
I think those are the most superficial comments I have ever heard about a democracy. We try to tell the people what they should know. We try to ferret out the secrets that are ultra secret in this White House. We know that the people have a right to know and that you cannot have a democracy without an informed people. Their aim is to keep, to run the show as they would in their power-bound ways and try to deny the people their right to know. And at some point, people will break loose. I think that we are absolutely essential. We are so necessary that you cannot have a democracy without a free press.
What is the angriest you've gotten in the White House?
Sounds like in my diatribe there. What is the angriest? I'm just outraged at secrecy when I know that these are not secrets, should be kept from the people. I think that makes me the most unhappy. These people are in power, and they can call the shots, and they can call the reporters, and they can. But what they have to do is to respect the people's right to know. And we are there. We are representing the pipeline to the people. They can't do without us. They need us.
Do you think that your heritage, being a Lebanese American, has an impact on the way you view your job, your role as a reporter, especially
now? I think I'm an American. And I think from the day I was born, I was so proud to know that I lived in a free country and that my father didn't miss the boat. Of course, I have certain cultural ties, and I guess I have a better understanding of the tragedy of the Middle East than a lot of people, because I'm really interested. But I don't think it turns me off. I mean, there's wherever people suffer, I think reporters want to be there. I mean, we are so lucky because being there is everything for a reporter, and caring.
What advice do you have for reporters coming to the White House as a person of great experience, having covered the White House for more than half a century.
I would say be challenging, be probing, be courteous, and understand that your mission is to find the truth wherever it leads you.
And what about when they say that kind of probing, the kind of aggressive questions you might ask, will cut off access?
I would say, so what? There are other ways to go down. There are other roads.
Helen Thomas, I want to thank you very much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Helen Thomas, White House correspondent for over half a century. She's author of three books. Her latest, Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, Wit and Wisdom from the Front Row at the White House, and Front Row at the White House, My Life and Times. Helen Thomas resigned from UPI in 2000 when Reverend Sun Myung-moon bought it. Reverend Sun Myung-moon also owns the Washington Times. Helen Thomas is now a columnist for Hearst News Service. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Telling me somebody's been picking in my cherry tree. Don't wanna be just about it by mistake. But I could tell someone's been digging around in my cage.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go live now to Baghdad with Michael Birmingham, Irish peace activist with Voices in the Wilderness, has been in Iraq since October 2002 and has been spending a good amount of time recently in Sadr City, where the Mehdi Army is based. Can you tell us what it is like there and who the Mehdi Army are?
Okay, well, at the moment, in Sadr City, people are really terrified of what's happening and what's going to happen. Most people aren't really sure exactly what's going on around them, and they don't know what to do. For instance, we've seen talk to people who are living, you know, at junctions where cars have been attacked by U.S. forces, the occupants killed. Most people, virtually everyone who we've talked to around, in those areas, is saying that the people who are driving the cars were maybe, for instance, just taxi drivers who are working late at night or other people traveling around, and they didn't know that they weren't supposed to be on the streets. For instance, I travel quite a lot at night in taxis, and even last night, two of the taxis that I had, I went out, I was driving around Sadr City late last night and inside and outside of Sadr City, and people simply don't know. I mean, they don't drive their taxi sometimes during the day because there's so many problems with streets blocked that they can't make any money, so they choose to drive at night when it's more dangerous because it's the only way they can make a living. They haven't been told they can't drive at night. Now they're wondering, you know, there's no actual official curfew there, but the people seem, from the report, certainly it's what there seem to be reasonably substantial reports that people are getting shot. So they're just confused and they're scared. The children, you know, I've stayed, you know, this week I stayed a few nights in two different houses in Sadr City, and the children in both houses are terrified. You know, they one 8-year-old boy his brother was, he was shaking, and his brother said he's scared. And the young boy said to me, no, I'm not scared of machine guns. They're normal. I'm scared of the missiles. And I mean, really, this is what's happening for people out there as the U.S. forces go on with their operations in what they say are attacks on the Mehdi army. Though it seems that a lot more people are getting caught in are getting the wrong end of their missiles and gunfire.
Michael Birmingham, coalition forces conducted what they called a precision raid in Baghdad's mainly Shia neighborhood of Sadr City early today, destroying a building that the coalition forces say are a base of operations for the Mehdi army. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the coalition faces a test of will in Iraq and warned the future of the Iraqi people is at stake. U.S. officials also saying that Sadr can only muster up a few hundred men. Can you respond?
If you drive around Sadr City, if you walk around Sadr City, you will see posters everywhere. Other than having lived in Iraq before the war and seeing the amount of posters of Saddam Hussein, it would be almost difficult to imagine how many posters there are of Muqtada Sadr, and not just in Sadr City, in Shia neighborhoods all over Baghdad. I haven't been down south for a few weeks, but they're certainly also in the mostly Shia south of Iraq. There is, a considerable number of people who are, what's actually quite common is for people to say that they either support Muqtada, or they may say they don't support him, that they support Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the other senior religious leader here for the Shia, the most senior religious leader here for the Shia, but they will say that they condemn the attacks which have been happening in recent time, and it's quite not very sustainable for Donald Rumsfeld to try and assert that there's just a few hundred. The Mehdi army has been, people can see with their own eyes that they have been conducting exercises in Taura, not with guns, mainly marching, and in because there's a religious festival on here at the moment for 40 days, and they're often to be seen on the streets. But we know they're well armed.
Michael Birmingham speaking to us from Baghdad in Iraq with Voices in Wilderness, has been in Iraq for more than a year. As we wrap up today with a report from Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Glantz in Iraq, the uprising there is spreading quickly, as many as six Iraqi cities experiencing fierce battles between Iraqis and U.S.-led foreign troops. Ukrainian forces were forced to evacuate the city of Kut, southwest of Baghdad, during the clashes with the Mehdi army, while there were clashes with Polish troops in the holy city of Karbala. We go now to Aaron Glantz.
The dead keep piling up in Fallujah. More than 200 Iraqi dead in the last 24 hours. Hospital officials report 16 children and 8 women killed when warplanes struck 4 houses late last night. 40 more Iraqis died when American helicopter gunships fired on a neighborhood mosque while it was filled with worshippers. 30 American soldiers are also dead. American Major John Clearfield.
The Fallujahans are going to realize that we're the strongest force in the city, and that it's in their best interest to reject these foreign fighters and these terrorists, and to embrace the coalition.
But many Iraqis say the American military crackdown will likely only increase violence. While battle raged in Fallujah, militants forced down a U.S. OH-58 Kiowa helicopter in Bakuba, 30 miles north of Baghdad, where former Iraqi Army General Farouk Ma'adan has been trying to broker a ceasefire. But with the American attacks on Fallujah and the Mehdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, the general is not optimistic.
You cannot blame anyone who shoots the Americans. You cannot say they were wrong because they are under occupation. And the Americans keep rolling and rolling in with the Apache helicopters and the tanks. All these things make people uncomfortable. It makes them restless. They just boil and boil and boil. What do you expect? There must be some kind of resistance.
The situation is exacerbated by the lack of an Iraqi government, which could make its own policy. The U.S. military launched its massive assault without approval from the Bush-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. Dr. Musla Abdul Hamid of the Sunni Iraqi Islamic Political Party, which holds a seat on the Governing Council, says they offered to negotiate with the rebels in Fallujah, but were turned down by the American army.
The Governing Council didn't make any important statement about the situation in Fallujah. And the people who believe in Muqtada al-Sadr believe the Governing Council didn't want to lose the support of the man on the street. But the Governing Council also is in contact with the occupation force.
The Governing Council has also been largely silent on the American crackdown on radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, which has provoked a violent reaction across southern Iraq. Zaid Sadi of the more moderate Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, whose leader Abdul Aziz al-Hakim was appointed to Bush's Iraqi Governing Council, says Sadr's Mehdi army is more than a gang of terrorists.
They are civilian people. They're workers, students, teachers. When they join the Mehdi army, they think they are better than before. They think otherwise, no one gives them their rights.
Zaid Sadi says to truly understand the anger of the poor young Shiite men who make up the Mehdi army, one has to look at the environment they grew up in. He cites 13 years of tough United Nations sanctions on Iraq, which choked the country's education system to a screeching halt.
There are a lot of people who are uneducated, who didn't finish secondary school. And because of the situation, our secondary school is nothing compared to other countries. At that time, the teachers were only paid $1 or $2 a month, and that's nothing.
Today, these boys, now young men, are facing the tanks and helicopters of George Bush's coalition of the willing, with Kalashnikovs, knives, and rocket-propelled grenades. They've taken the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala, along with nearby Kut. In Nasiriya, they have kidnapped two Korean human rights workers. They say they won't release them until the American army releases their comrades. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz, Iraq.
And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can see comprehensive coverage of Iraq, as well as the 9/11 Commission, as well as transcripts of all our conversations with our guests. Looking forward to the beginning of our Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour, which is kicking off on Tuesday, April 13th, here in New York at Cooper Union's Great Hall at Astor Place, 5:30 reception, 7 o'clock event with Tim Robbins and WBAI's Bernard White and my co-host Juan Gonzalez, my co-author and brother David Goodman. You can call us at 212-431-9090, 212-431-9090. Then it's Fresno and then Berkeley on April 15th. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman.